So one of the nice things about going last is I don't have to explain a lot of the stuff that Jennifer and Sarah already did, so saves all of us a little time. So I'm going to talk to you today about exposure to the World Trade Center disaster and 9/11 related PTSD and household disaster preparedness. So disasters, both natural and human-made, I heard somebody at an earlier session call it, to not place all the blame on men. So human-made disasters are inevitable, and the global trends have shown an increase in the incidence and severity of natural disasters in the past decade. And one of the most effective ways to mitigate the effects of disasters is through proper household preparedness. Despite this, only 25% of U.S. households currently adhere to the minimum preparedness guidelines that are set forth by groups like the American Red Cross and FEMA and Department of Homeland Security. And 30 to 40% of households have some emergency supplies and a family plan. Just so everybody here knows, the items for a basic disaster supply kit include a 3-day supply of water, food, and any needed medication for people in the household, battery-powered radio, and a can opener, not the kind that you need electricity for, flashlights with extra batteries, first aid kit, sanitation and hygiene items like diapers if there are children in the house, extra clothing, copies of important documents, and an evacuation plan. So there's quite a bit of research out there on what is associated with preparedness. Studies have found that socio-demographic factors like age, education, and income, having older age, higher education, and higher income is associated with being more prepared in both U.S. and international samples. And multiple large-scale studies have shown that minority race ethnicities is being associated with lower levels of preparedness. And other studies have noted that having medical vulnerabilities, like disabilities or chronic medical conditions, is located or is associated with a lack of disaster preparedness, and that people with serious mental illness and frequent mental distress are also less likely to be prepared. And similarly, quality of life measures like perceived general health, those with poor perceived general health are more likely or less likely to be prepared than those who perceive their health to be excellent. And those with low social and emotional support also tend to be less prepared. But when one searches the literature on what effect does prior disaster experience have on people's ability to prepare, the literature isn't really as clear-cut. Some publications say that prior disaster experience leads to higher levels of preparedness. One study showed that the intensity of exposure to the World Trade Center disaster led to higher levels of preparedness among a random sample of New York City adults, while other studies have said that this prior disaster experience leads to no change in future preparedness as part of the 2009 National Survival Initiative, a survey among Atlantic and Gulf coastal states who have a lot of hurricane experience. Only 66% of households had no emergency or hurricane disaster supplies, and 55% had no family plan on what to do if there was a hurricane. And then finally, kind of like a little Goldilocks thing, some of them says, well, it really depends on what you look at and what your measurement of preparedness is. After the 2005 London subway bombing, a study found an increase in emergency planning, but no change in the number of people who actually gathered supplies. But one of the things when it comes to prior disaster experience that does seem to be pretty consistent in the literature are negative outcomes of that prior disaster experience, and that prior hurricane and earthquake exposures that led to property loss and cost of damage were predictive of future preparedness, and that those people who suffered psychological distress and negative memories from prior disaster experience were also more likely to be prepared. So Hurricane Sandy struck the northeastern United States on October 29, 2012, and it was the largest and second costliest hurricane in U.S. history, resulting in numerous deaths and $50 to $65 billion in damages. And some of these people exposed to the events of 9/11, which Sarah had just spoke about, which resulted in the death of about 3,000 people and severely impacted the psychological well-being of area residents, were also affected by Hurricane Sandy. And so just for some timeline, Hurricane Sandy hit roughly at the end of our, of the registry's wave three data collection, which ended in November 2012. So that will be important in a minute. So this map here just gives you an idea. In the red and the blue are the high surge areas for Hurricane Sandy. Blue is New Jersey and red is New York City. And all of those little black dots are wave three survey respondents. And so, let's see if I can get the little guy here. So areas here, like this is Lower Manhattan, where the attacks took place. And here we have Staten Island and the Far Rockaways, where a lot of our 9/11 rescue recovery workers live. You can see we're also affected by 9/11. And so registry resources allowed us to conduct a relatively rapid survey of those affected by Sandy and their mental and physical health outcomes from Hurricane Sandy. So on the data collection, when we were collecting the sample on people who were going to get the Hurricane Sandy data survey, they had to have completed the adult wave three survey, which, as I had mentioned, just had recently ended. They were sampled in two groups. First group was in the inundation zone, so 4,435 people, and then an equal number of people were sampled that lived in the non-inundation zone. And they completed a self-administered web and or paper survey between March and November 2013. And the overall response rate was just over 51%, with about 54% response in the inundation zone and 46% in the non-inundation zone. So the overall Sandy survey objectives were to assess Sandy-related exposures and subsequent trauma and frequent or physical adversity among persons with prior exposure to World Trade Center disaster, and to investigate the emergence and amplification and reemergence of PTSD among persons who experienced 9/11 related trauma, and identify factors associated with physical health effects and resilience in this population. This analysis, the specific objectives for this study were to describe the levels of preparedness for Hurricane Sandy, and to investigate the relationships between preparedness and 9/11 related PTSD, social support, and 9/11 exposure. So to be included in this analysis, you had to be 18 years or older, and you had to complete all three of our survey waves. And you were excluded if you didn't answer the outcome question on preparedness. So there were 62 people that had to be excluded for a final sample of 4,496. And the dependent variable was the question, which of the following did your household have prepared before Sandy happened? And this was a check all that applied type question. They could check up to 8 items, a 3-day supply of water, food and snacks, medication, a flashlight, personal care items, a first aid kit, battery operated radio, or an evacuation plan. Or they could have also responded none of the above, that they didn't collect any of those items. And so we define preparedness as basically missing no more than one of the items. So they had to check 7 or 8 items and they were considered prepared. So, and if they were missing 2 or more, then they were not prepared. The independent variables are standard demographics, race, ethnicity, gender, 2010 household income, and age. We looked at medical factors reported at wave 3. So this was self-report of physician diagnosis of asthma, diabetes, and coronary heart disease. We looked at mental health factors like social support, which was a five-item summary measure that asked questions about, do you have somebody to take you to the doctor, somebody to hug you, somebody to help you with meals if you can't. And these were summed and then categorized into low, medium, high, and very high social support. And we looked at PTSD by the PCL-17 at wave 3. Our World Trade Center exposure was a 12-item summary measure from wave 1, where we asked questions about exposure to the dust cloud, having an injury, 9/11-related job loss, having lost a friend or family member. And then these were summed and then further categorized into none or low exposure, which was 0 to 1, medium, 2 to 3 exposures, high was 4 to 5 exposures, and very high was 6 or more exposures. And then in the Hurricane Sandy survey, we asked whether the participant knew if they lived in an evacuation zone. The New York City evacuated Zone A got a mandatory evacuation. So we asked them if they knew that they lived in an evacuation zone, if they knew they did not, or if they didn't know whether or not they lived in an evacuation zone. So our analyses, we did descriptive statistics to describe the level of preparedness and the most and least frequently reported items. And then we compared those prepared to those not prepared using bivariate analyses and multivariable regression, where our reference group is not prepared. And so here's just some quick demographics and characteristics of the study population. 56% were male, the majority were white, 63% between the ages of 45 and 64, and 58% made more than $75,000 in 2010. 22% had reported having asthma, 11% diabetes, and 5% coronary heart disease. 19% had screened positive for PTSD at wave 3. 42% had had social support. Just about a quarter said that they didn't know whether or not they lived in an evacuation zone, and 11% had very high World Trade Center exposure. So when we look at the distribution of how many preparedness items people had, less than 5% checked that they had none of the above. So that was encouraging, at least. And then about 37% met our definition of prepared, meaning they had 7 or 8 items checked, with almost 19% reporting having all 8 items. The items most frequently reported were flashlight, followed by personal care and hygiene items, and then food and snacks. And the least common was having an evacuation plan. And so looking at some of the multivariable analyses, at those demographic factors, similar to what previous publications have shown, the older age groups were had higher odds of being prepared compared to the 18 to 44 age group. And when we look at race ethnicity, while they're not all statistically significant, all of their odds ratios are, they're all less, the minority races are less likely to be prepared compared to non-Hispanic whites, which is consistent with the literature. And when we look at those medical factors, the only one that was significantly associated with preparedness was asthma. And in this case, those with asthma were 20% more likely to be prepared compared to those without asthma. And our mental health factors, probable PTSD at wave 3 was not statistically significantly associated with being prepared, but about the 20% more likely to be prepared compared to those with no PTSD. And when we look at social support, we see as social support increases, the odds of you being prepared increase, with those in the very high social support being almost twice as likely to be prepared compared to those in the low social support category. And looking at some of those other factors, at the knowledge of living in an evacuation zone for Hurricane Sandy. So if people knew they lived in an evacuation zone, they were almost twice as likely to be prepared compared to those who didn't know. But even for those people who knew they didn't live in an evacuation zone, we're still 70% more likely to be prepared compared to those who didn't know. And I think that's probably just some personality traits of those types of people who would seek out that information, but it was still interesting nonetheless. And when we look at World Trade Center exposure, similar to what we saw with social support, with the increasing levels of exposure to 9/11, the more likely the person was to be prepared, with those in the very high exposure group being 80% more likely to be prepared compared to those in the none or low exposure group. And so even though PTSD at wave 3 was not significantly associated, we still were interested to see whether the relationship between exposure and preparedness differed among those with and without PTSD. And so we did a stratified analysis here using a common reference group of no probable PTSD and none or low exposure. And the trends for both those with and without PTSD are the same. As exposure levels increase, your odds of being prepared increase, although the odds ratios are slightly higher among those with probable PTSD, but overlapping odds ratios leads one to think they're probably not statistically significantly different from each other. And so in summary, over a third of respondents were prepared for Hurricane Sandy, with less than 5% saying that they did nothing to prepare. Social support increased the likelihood of being prepared. 9/11 related PTSD was not associated with being prepared, but World Trade Center was associated with being prepared regardless of PTSD status, with some slightly higher odds among those with PTSD. And so strengths and limitations, of course. Limitations, the measure that we used for preparedness, this kind of 8 objective item list, is consistent with what the rest of the field uses, but really the only thing that speaks exclusively to being prepared is having an evacuation plan, and that was the item that was least reported among participants, and really nothing else speaks to the functionality of these items, whether they were just things that people commonly have on hand or if they were bought for this specific purpose. So I think some retooling and reworking of some measures of preparedness that are needed in the field. Potential recall bias with the time between Hurricane Sandy and our survey, selection bias, and then generalizability. This population had high exposures to 9/11, and so the findings might not be generalizable to other populations. Some of the strengths, we had a large sample size. We had a wide range of data on sociodemographic, physical, and mental health outcomes over several years and their prior 9/11 exposure. And then we had preparedness to an actual event. Most of the other literature out there, there's no imminent threat when people are asked about preparedness, which I think might, if there actually was an imminent threat, might change how they actually respond. And so I think that makes our study a little unique. And so recommendations are that messaging to encourage supply gathering behaviors, but in particular evacuation planning, and that community support be leveraged for this messaging, because people can learn about being prepared from the media, but that information and knowledge alone is rarely sufficient to really induce behavior change. But if people that care about you tell you how important it is, it might then make the act of preparedness more important than something you actually undertake. And that we should target providers and community outreach groups who have contact with vulnerable populations and individuals characterized by low social support, like undocumented migrant workers, homebound older adults, who would benefit from some further preparedness outreach and awareness. And so I just want to quickly thank my co-authors at the registry, Steve Stellman, Robert Grackbill, and Kim Karamanica, and at the Office of Preparedness and Emergency Response at DOHMH, San Francisco, and of course, none of this would be possible without our funders. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? Yes. Wait, could you introduce yourself?
I guess I should supposed to talk about this. yeah, you know, I think you know, social it is kind of a nebulous factor, but we haven't really looked into the mechanisms, but in talking to the people that do the everyday preparedness work, I think it really has to do with more social norms, maybe, and that if you feel like people care about you or you see other people doing this behavior, you're more likely to do that same behavior or think it's important. You know, we have some other questions on that survey that at the time of this analysis I didn't look at, but we have other questions on like social integration, like how many friends do you have, religious services, volunteer work, that type of stuff. So I think, you know, in the future, maybe looking at both of the two together or separately and seeing how they play together might be of interest. But I think it's probably more of a, you know, a social norm or network type situation.
I have a question about your asthma crisis. Mm-hmm. That was an adjusted.
Yes.
Oh, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, could we, so for everybody else, World Trade Center is a known cause of or being associated with asthma. So I'm wondering if your measure of World Trade Center exposure, because it was a whole slew of kinds of things, if maybe if you had looked at only dust exposure, versus no dust exposure, if that asthma association would decrease, or how, if you thought about why that is associated a little bit more.
Oh, with preparedness?
Yeah.
Maybe if I pulled dust out of the World Trade Center exposure and control for that separately, it could, you know, and for the most part, what the literature says that people with these chronic conditions do tend to be less prepared. Some people have gone down to the nitty gritty, and while they're less overall prepared, they're more likely to have medications on hand. They're more likely to have certain things on hand, so I don't know if that, is somehow, playing a role in overriding everything else. Looking at that dust exposure separately. I don't know. I didn't do that, but that's...
What I'd like to do right now is invite the two other speakers to come up, and so we can have a little bit of a discussion. We have some time. I also wanted to mention that for the whole reason that we have this session today, along with other sessions that are related to disasters and preparedness, have to do with the fact that CSTE has a disaster epidemiology subcommittee that has active working groups, and we recognize the importance of doing the work. Whether it is disaster mental health work, whether it is the preparedness work, whatever. And so that's kind of why this is here, and that's why we are here. And at least, if not for other disasters as well, at least for the NIOSH perspective on the Emergency Responder Health Monitoring Surveillance System, that's a direct outgrowth of 9/11 and what happened at Ground Zero. And I think that what has happened in New York has, if you would, set the stage for a lot of increased awareness and understanding of hazards and risks and susceptibility. And it has started being not only an example of what can be done, but has spurred other people throughout the United States and state and local health departments to take action around disaster epidemiology so that we can do a better job of being prepared and being able to respond as a government. So to that end, I also want to invite you to a round table presentation that's happening today at 5:45 in Beacon F, which is on the third floor of the hotel. Right next door, that will be meeting specifically with this. But having said all of that, I want to now invite you to ask any generalized questions, have a discussion, we'd love to hear from some of you about your experiences, your preparedness, whatever. We've got some time, let's use it.
Funding from NIOSH for more research, started in about 8 years ago, and that is when we were able to develop a research team. It has grown from about 4 of us to now Jen, and we have a few other newish at this point, and we've done a lot of work since then. We're over 10 people now, with data analysts and epidemiologists on the team. So it's mostly World Trade Center focused. There are sometimes smaller other quality assurance things that come up with the World Trade Center Health Program or the fire department in general, and it's kind of sort to us just because of our process. But it's not a unique, I mean, it's a unique situation.
That's it.
My question is for the last presenter.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, okay. The fire by the CDC Atlanta. I know you mentioned the household preparedness around 23%,
25%,
FEMA, you recommend from 80%.
Recommend.
It's very low, 80%.
They recommend.
They recommend.
Yeah.
The recommendation in general is very far, very low person to have the household preparedness. I don't know, probably it might help you to see the social vulnerability. Are you familiar with social vulnerability?
Very superficially.
Yeah, I mean, the social vulnerability index is scaled from 0 to 1. So it gives you the whole United States. Is available online, interactive map, and the closest to one high vulnerable community, of course, it's back there. So it will help you to identify the county or the globe based on social vulnerability index and the probability. It might help you to at least to look partners in the future to build their communities and build their development. The kind of comments I have to focus on. If you even look at the daily map, you find the social wealth index, it gives you a good picture, where to be a good resource.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the low, I think being why people are not prepared is probably very complex, you know, but just when we were talking the other day, you know, I just recently moved to New York City about just over a year ago from Atlanta, and, you know, 3 days to supply of water is, I mean, it's supposed to be what, like a gallon or something. It's a gallon a day per person. You know, if there's 4 of you living in an apartment in New York City and you have to have that much water, I don't know where you're going to put it. You know, so there's those types of things that, you know, people have to take into consideration. You know, the money, of course, when it comes to social vulnerability also tends to be economically vulnerable, so they can't afford to have just these things lying around. And then I think, you know, I grew up from about 5 years old to 18 in South Florida, you know, lots of hurricanes. You know, we were there for Andrew, lost everything. But, you know, people you see that every year, you know, oh, you know, they have hurricane parties. Oh, we've had 6 hurricanes last year and nothing happened, and we're going to be fine this year. So I think it's a mix of all of those types of things on people just becoming desensitized to it, not being able to afford to do it, not think it's important, have other priorities, you know, not having the support to go out and, you know, buy these things. You know, if they're homebound and they don't have a support system to help them go out and buy, you know, all of these items to have in the house, then they're not going to be able to do it.
So how many people here in this room have met the minimum, preparedness criteria? Raise your hand if you have. So, so a higher proportion in this room than at least in around the area, but... and I don't know that I'm exactly at 7 or whatever it is, but we're closer to, yeah, so that's an issue.
But, yeah, I mean, hurricanes, in Florida, you grow the hurricanes, but I don't think people in New York have grown up with hurricanes. And so, I mean, you prepare for the kind of disaster in their area.
Well, yeah.
We prepare for earthquakes in California, but not hurricanes. So there's a little different,
But they're you know, the process is still the same. You know, they still, you know, here, you know, in New York or Boston, you know, bad snowstorm and, you know, or you know, you're out without electricity for a couple of days, or, you know, or you get a blizzard, 3 feet of snow like they had here this past winter, and you can't leave your house, and having those types of things on hand. So I still think it's, it's for the most part the same practice. Right, and maybe that's, you know, they think that you know, maybe people in the Northeast think that, oh, that's only people that have hurricanes or earthquakes or tornadoes in the Midwest think of, and, you know, or people that earthquakes, they're like, well, I don't have any fair warning, why should I bother? Because it's not going to do me good, because I'm not going to know when it's coming. You know, so.
And so I wonder how much that.
And we actually, yeah, you know, hindsight's 2020. We actually do ask in the Sandy survey about, I think Irene was the hurricane,
yeah.
I remember, asked if they evacuated for Hurricane Irene. So, you know, if I could go back and do it all over again, you know, that would be definitely one of the questions I would look at, with, you know, is their evacuation behavior before they evacuated for something that ended up being a no big deal. Did that, less, you know, increase or decrease their chances of preparedness? You know, we have a another study that's being done by a collaborator at the health department looking at evacuation for Sandy, and that evacuation for Irene, even though it wasn't a big deal, was still predictive of people evacuating for Sandy.
Question here and then back there.
Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm the director of the health program. Just an overall comment about the evacuation plan. And I dealt with some pretty old data when I looked at this from our training department, that they had surveyed if people had evacuation plans. And then I looked at it and I said, well, do you ever ask them why they don't have it? And there's just that kind of different now. I said, do you ever go back to ask why they don't have it? No. So when they resurveyed last year, we found that people didn't understand what that meant. And they had no idea where to find out if they were in an evacuation zone. They had no idea how to develop a plan and even understand what goes into it. So we created a template. It's 4 pages long, and it's really simple. And we handed out all of our trainings, and it's working. So people are much more likely to have an evacuation plan when they use our template. And like I said, it's easy peasy. It's 2 pages front and back. It's got everything from like medical information to tests, how to take care of your pets in disasters, because we found out that people will not leave their home, not self-included. I will not leave without my pets. So to us in Delaware, that was tremendously helpful. And even though we don't post where sheltering is, we don't want people showing up to shelters if it's not open. We do give them information of where to go, or we have a blast radio station of where to, and our 211 of where they can call and find out shelters and things like that. So that might be
And I think that, you know, that the knowledge is, and that was something that had come up, you know, in discussions after this analysis with our Office of Preparedness, was, you know, do people, you know, do they really know what preparedness is, and you know, they, like I said, you know, they have everybody has flashlights on hand. Does that really mean anything? You know, that 90% of people said they flashlight. I would assume so. You know, so I think a better refinement, asking these kind of more knowledge questions. You know, do you know what an evacuation plan is? Do you know what a go bag is? What a shelter in place plan is? You know, all of those types of things will help us really tease out where we focus a lot of our efforts.
Exactly, and I think the list that you showed is, you know, the first three are on you. It's very basic, because if you ever look at the FEMA list for preparedness, you have to be a millionaire, and you need like a whole like garage to be able to store some of that stuff. So I live in an apartment in Delaware, and I don't even have that. So if you gotta think about your population, you need some bunch of lists that go out there. But
I mean, even the important documents, you know what I mean? Like, I consider myself prepared. I mean, I have a bag at work. When I had a car, I had a bag in the car. I have a bag at home. I have a bag for the dogs at home. But I don't have copies of important documents. I don't even know really what do they mean by important. Copy my birth certificate? I don't know. So,
You
know, there's definitely things on them that I don't have.
It's in the back, and then
Sean McBride, I work infectious disease epi, so this is kind of a lot new to me as far as what we're doing. But, you know, a lot of times in just communicating to in trying to change health behaviors and things like that, and even preparedness, I see there's that hurdle of people believe they're an exception until they have that experience. And you can communicate a lot of, a certain high proportion of people who have a health behavior will experience negative health outcomes, things like that. And a lot of times, sometimes you don't see the change in health behavior that you would expect to see, or would hope to see. And I mean, is that, do you think, impacting what you're seeing as far as the preparedness goes?
With
people who had a negative experience increasing their preparedness because they're no longer having that, and how best you communicate with someone that, there's as much risk as someone who's previously experienced these things, particularly with
In my previous life before this, I did a lot of adolescent childhood vaccine work, and I think it's end up with a similar, not my kid type situation. My kid's not gonna get sick, but we found in vaccine work that testimonials, parents talking about their child getting meningitis, or their child going deaf from chickenpox, and all those types of things were very effective for other parents. And so maybe when it comes to some of the commercials or radio messaging that the health department does and the city's Office of Emergency Management, having some kind of testimonials about people who have lost homes or loved ones in previous disasters. I mean, for Sandy, there's still people that still don't have their homes, this many, years later. And I think, people understanding that and being able to relate to that might, right, make them be like, oh, well, this person's just like me, and if it happened to them, it happened to me. So I think the lessons can be learned from the way other fields work to try to change behavior.
Jason.
I might have missed it during the description, but what's the biological connection, if any, between World Trade Center exposure and Delta Room Fair arthritis? Are there specific compounds that are thought to be autoimmune triggers?
One that is fairly well studied is crystalline silica. I can't quite speak to how it works. I'm not a doctor, but that's been found to be associated with both rheumatoid arthritis and just autoimmune disease in general. And then there are some hypothesized mechanisms that would link post-traumatic stress disorder to autoimmune diseases. They're both inflammatory. You have inflammatory stress reactions, leading to increased inflammation, which might contribute to autoimmune disease, could contribute to immune dysregulation. But I think they're kind of more hypothetical.
Sure. This could be for Energy Orbs from Delaware. just thinking about the evacuation lanes, I was thinking in my head, okay, well, but I was like, well, I'd get my car and drive somewhere. Well, so is everybody else. is there somewhere, and maybe on the FEMA website or something, but is there somewhere like that available to people, or do you know where, how to explain how to make an evacuation plan? Is that found somewhere?
Any other questions or comments?
Just one about the preparedness kit. We left here, there was an earthquake in California, and so we did a community assessment and found that about half the injuries that were sustained were actually sustained during the cleanup phase. At which point we realized it's probably a really good idea to have recommendations for California to have heavy gloves. I'm wondering, from the study, is there a free-form field for people to what was included in their kit? What among these, is there some sort of aha moment?
not that I, if there was no like option to say other than write something in, and you know, I'm not completely familiar with some people, you know, there was kind of freehand stuff that people had written in, but I don't remember, recall any of it really being about preparedness. It was more of like, you know, potential injuries or what happened after or where they went, you know, other type of qualitative information, but nothing about preparedness per se. And, you know, the question was written before I got there in collaboration with our preparedness office. So, you know, I think, like we were saying about the knowledge, you know, after when, you know, when I got on and did the analysis, it was one of those, like, oh, it would have been nice to ask this. And so they might have some things now looking back on, you know, our Casper data and all the other stuff that we've done for Hurricane Sandy, going back and seeing, you know, maybe refining what a preparedness and a go bag or a preparedness kit for New York City residents, what that might mean for different situations.
And you mentioned that you had a bag for your dog.
I do.
And so did he, in this questionnaire, include
We didn't ask that. We asked, so if people followed the skip pattern appropriately, they were asked if they evacuated, yes or no. They were asked if they evacuated, did they evacuate before, during, or after the storm? And of those who evacuated, if you had pets, were they evacuated with you? Yes, no, don't know. Those who had pets were definitely less likely to evacuate before the storm. Even though New York City, they do allow pets in shelters, and that might just be a matter of getting the information out there to pet owners that they just don't know that they can bring their pet with them. But, you know, like you had said, the pets definitely hinder the process. Because me as well, I mean, I wouldn't leave my house if I couldn't take my dogs. I did volunteer work for the American Humane Society after Katrina. You know, one of the people out there in the community is trying to get dogs off of front porches and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I don't blame those people for not leaving, and I think a lot has changed for sheltering, and people have that knowledge now that people aren't going to leave the house if they can't take their pet with them.
Just to respond to a comment that you made, in Oklahoma, following the spate of Category 5 tornadoes, the analysis that was published not too long ago by the researchers in Oklahoma identified that 55% of the injuries associated with those tornadoes happened during the cleanup phase.
Robert Brackville from our group published an MWR on injuries from our survey. And I know the health department also has a separate study that they've done on injuries on Hurricane Sandy. I can't recall what the findings were.
It's certainly something to be aware of. Well, we have a reception tonight. I don't even know what time the reception is, but that's across the street. We have our disaster EPI roundtable. We'd love to have you there. But please join me in thanking our wonderful speakers for their session. Thank you very much. And thank you all for attending.